the week of January 31st, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gelbs.
Yes, industry expert Karen Woodward and freelance entertainment journalist Michael Gelbs, whose writing can be found on the Huffington Post, among other sources, will be joined this week by Jeff Boucher from the Los Angeles Times, who's going to be joining us to talk about the Grammys a little later on, and Allison Wilmore from IFC, who's going to be joining us to wrap up all the Sundance coverage. But I know every week we begin with box office, and it's getting more and more interesting each week that Avatar stays in first place.
Well, that makes two of you who think so.
Karen's going to be fascinated. We have more to discuss about Avatar. For the seventh week in a row, Avatar is the number one film in the country. For the seventh week in a row, it's over $30 million. At this point, every week it's setting a new record of some sort. So it was number one. It grossed $31 million. It's at $595 million. We're taping this podcast on a Monday. Sometime today or perhaps tomorrow, it will become the highest grossing film in North America of all time, in pure box office dollars. And of course, overseas, it's already the top grossing overseas film. It's the first film in history to gross over $2 billion. It's The Blue Men Are Amazing. And Sperling, now and forever, when there's any movie with blue men in it, I will defer to you because I never would have predicted it, especially after I saw the movie. When Yellow Submarine comes out and the Blue Meanies are in it, you are the expert and I will bow to whatever you say about the movie. The number two film of the week was Edge of Darkness with Mel Gibson. It had a so-so, not awful opening at $17 million. Number three was the Kristen Bell, Josh Duhamel romantic comedy When in Rome, which opened fairly softly at $12 million. Kristen Bell is still looking for her breakout movie role. She is a great talk show guest already, though. Number four was The Tooth Fairy with Dwayne The Rock Johnson at $9.9 million, a not bad hold for a family film. Number five was Book of Eli, the Denzel Washington vehicle at $74 million total. Number six was Legion, the Angels Coming to Earth movie, which is already dropping fast. It's at $28 million. The Lovely Bones is falling fast. That's at $38 million total. Sherlock Holmes is just an inch away from $200 million. Alvin and the Chipmunks is over $200 million and just edging towards the gross for the first film. And Meryl Streep's It's Complicated has grossed $100 million and $104 million in the U.S. and just about there at the same amount overseas. The Blind Side, by the way, fell out of the top 10 for the first time. Its gross total is $237 million. And two little things I noticed when I was looking up the box office this week. One is that Inglourious Basterds, the Tarantino film, is at $320 million worldwide, by far his biggest hit. He's grossed over $200 million overseas. And Up, the Pixar film, has quietly become their second highest grossing film of all time at $727 million. It's behind Finding Nemo, which is by far their biggest hit, but it is yet another massive smash hit for Pixar. So that's the box office for this week. I actually drove to the theater right 20 minutes before When in Rome and Edge of Darkness were opening. I parked the car and I just couldn't bring myself to go in. I just didn't care. Did anybody go to the movies this weekend?
Well, it depends. I was at Sundance, so I saw some Sundance movies.
Doesn't count. Karen?
Nah, we don't care about that. No, I spent my entire weekend trying to buy a new smartphone. So there was no time for movies. But I have to admit, I was sort of curious to see When in Rome, even though the reviews are awful. And I'm sure the movie is really silly and stupid, but I still want to see it.
Yes. Yeah, I kind of wanted to see it too, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Well, I know you don't want to talk any more about Avatar, Karen, as we discussed last week.
But we have to.
I mean, there were a number of stories generated this week about the box office, mainly quoting Paul DeGarabedian from Hollywood.com's box office division. He's the head of the box office division over there. And I guess so far, Avatar sold 56 million tickets in North America, while Titanic sold 128 million. And I liked what you said here in our show notes, Michael, that if Avatar were to sell as many tickets as Titanic, it would make $1.1 billion in the United States alone.
Well, there's a lot of comparisons. We'd love to have actual ticket sales for every movie going back to the 20s, but it's not possible. And we've got to take into account it's got a higher, ticket price. But that's been true throughout history. Hollywood has always charged a premium for movies, big expensive movies like Gone with the Wind and West Side Story. They've had road shows for decades. It's not anything new. If other movies could charge that much, they would. And, if we're just going to look at it compared to other movies today, every other movie could charge that much. And Titanic is still one of only five movies in history to gross over $1 billion. at the box office, and it's their only one to gross over $2 billion. So however you cut it, however they got there, it is still a significant accomplishment.
Well, Patrick Goldstein in the Los Angeles Times had an article or a column titled, "Is This a Box Office Record?" with an asterisk. And he says, "To say the chart we normally use is weighted toward modern-day movies would be an understatement." So this is an article or a column about the fact that Avatar is charging more, it's selling fewer tickets, and yet is still on the all-time box office list. It's still the topper.
It's true. I mean, when you adjust for inflation, which isn't actually a perfectly fair comparison anyway, especially when you're talking about different eras like the 30s. But yeah,
for inflation. Why not? Why is it not a fair comparison?
Because there were fewer entertainment options in the 1930s. You couldn't just go home and watch television. So more people went to the movies, whereas now fewer people go to the movies because you have video games and television and radio. I mean, there's just more.
It's kind of apples and oranges. Plus, the modern box office undercounts family films. Look at all the Pixar films. Those movies had to get to that total with lots of kid cut prices. So not only do they not get to charge extra, they charge half the normal price for a lot of their ticket sales. You take your kids to Up, they might be charged, $4 rather than $8. So they're
undervalued. But you're also doubling a ticket price because a kid can't go to Up by himself.
Well, yes, but a parent brings – yeah, but nonetheless, you have to sell a lot more tickets to get up to where it is. Same with Sound of Music and E.T. the Extraterrestrial. A lot of those ticket sales are just children. People felt it was worth the while to go to the movie and buy a ticket, but when it's a kid price, it's cheaper. So I'm saying they're undervalued. So, it's really, really gets complicated to sort of compare different genres, different movies, 3D movies to regular. Pure ticket sales would be a great comparison. They're just not available earlier than the late 80s.
Well, adjusting for inflation – rounding out the top 10, Gone with the Wind would be the easy winner, whereas George Lucas's Star Wars, the 1977 version, would be number 2. Coming in at number 3 would be The Sound of Music, and then Steven Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial would be in 4th, and The Ten Commandments would be in 5th place, and 6th would be Titanic. And I like what Patrick Goldstein had to say here. He basically says, "I'd like to know how many people are seeing these movies." That's really the mark of success, is how many people within the population went to go see your movie.
Well, adjusting for inflation doesn't take into account like the silent era where movies were incredibly inexpensive, and tracking even grosses is incredibly hard. So there are Charlie Chaplin films and wildly popular films from the silent era that would probably be up there as well, but we just don't have the figures.
Well, I like the interesting example that Michael dug up of the Avatar plot fail.
That was me, of course. Me.
Oh, I thought it was Michael. Sorry.
We should put our names by
anything that's like anti-Avatar, is me.
I thought it was funny. It was basically Disney's Pocahontas treatment.
Right.
With all of the information, like every time it mentioned a name, it was scratched out and something from Avatar was written in.
That's true.
Like every location was scratched out and Pandora was written in. I thought that was very funny. And I also like the breakdown of Avatar costs. CGI rendering, $310 million for the budget.
Yeah, plot script, $150.
Well, a movie that everybody thinks is good is The Hurt Locker, and its director, Kathryn Bigelow, became the first woman to win a DGA award on, I believe it was Saturday night.
Yay!
Okay, I think you screamed so loud that you broke up. But, we were wondering whether she would win this award, and she did. She beat out her ex-husband, James Cameron, for Avatar. She beat out Jason Reitman. She beat out a bunch of people, all men. Norman Jewison was also at the event. He received a Lifetime Achievement Award. Of course, he is the director of Moonstruck and Fiddler on the Roof.
Wee!
Oi! L'chaim!
While we're talking about award winners, should we just get some of our guests on to talk about the Grammys, which happened last night?
Yeah.
Well, I just got an email from David Wilde, who is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, and of course he writes for the Huffington Post, and he was one of the writers on the Grammy Awards show last night, and he said he might be able to join us. Should I give him a call?
Do he and Jeff Boucher know each other?
They will now.
Great, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, joining us now, both by phone and both in Los Angeles, is, Jeff Boucher, who covers the music and film industries for the Los Angeles Times, and he is touted, according to the newspaper's website, as the paper's go-to geek, and he was a little busy yesterday evening covering the Grammys, so he either hasn't slept yet or is just waking up. Also joining us is Rolling Stone contributing editor and Huffington Post writer and one of the writers of the Grammys, David Wilde, who's joined us before. Welcome.
Hey there, guys.
Hi, I'm here.
Hi. So what was the big takeaway from last night, Jeff, as a journalist covering the Grammys? What was the big story?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of things to look at. As far as the show itself, as performance and as entertainment, I actually thought it was a pretty good show. Coming in, there wasn't the number of acts that I really like as there had been in some past years, so I wasn't sure what to expect. But I thought the stagings were good. I thought there were some really interesting moments. I thought the Pink performance was pretty great. I liked the opening sequence. And then as far as the award winners, you know, clearly you don't need to be able to sing to win Album of the Year.
Oh, we were just talking about that, about Taylor Swift's duet with Stevie Nicks. Oh.
Yeah. Well, I think winning Album of the Year will take the sting out of that. But I agree with you. I had no interest in almost all the major categories. I was hoping Maxwell would be up for Album of the Year at least. And yet, I thought it was one of the best produced shows because they had about 10 awards given out on the air, 10 or 12. It was mostly about the performances, which is what I care about most. And there was a really high standard of quality, I thought, this year. There were a lot of good performances.
Yeah, 16 performances, too. It was a full load.
Now, David, It seemed like there were more performances than actual awards. And according to what Michael just said, that is the case.
Yeah, it seems like that because it was like that.
So why is that, that there are fewer awards handed out during the telecast?
Well, it's not exactly a new trend. It's something that's been going on for the last, I'd say, 5 years. And I think Ken Ehrlich, who puts the show together creatively, basically has been a big proponent of the performance drives the event. But on the other hand, I think the awards, the reason I think the ratings were up, and since no one else has said it, I'll say it, the ratings were way up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. By about 40% over the last year, and the highest in 6 years. It was 25.8 million viewers, I think.
Yeah, it's a remarkable increase. And I think it's because there was a story, you know, I know in every bumper and every line we were hoping that this story would come across, which was this ladies' night, and would it be Taylor, would it be Beyonce, would it be Gaga, these women who, you know, come on so strong and ultimately ended up being a story with literally the fairy tale ending, especially if you're 14.
Absolutely. She gets a duet with her idol Stevie Nicks on air, however weekly, and then she gets to win the Grammy for Best Album, and Beyonce won the most awards in one night for any female artist, and Pink opened the show with a great really good performance, I think, with Elton John, which sort of
actually that was Lady Gaga.
I mean, Lady Gaga, I beg your pardon, with her duet with Elton John, which is similar to what she's doing on stage in her elaborate show. It worked out absolutely perfectly to script.
And even the Drake with Eminem and Lil Wayne, that was a fantastic performance.
Well, I thought Eminem wiped the floor with them. What did you think, Jeff?
Oh, I think, I think Marshall is in a class of his own in that performance, but I think you're right that it was also compelling. I don't know how enjoyable it was for the television audience. It sounded like a broken video game. But in the venue, it was pretty amazing.
The first four times they just went to quiet noise. I thought I'd press the mute button.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because of the profanity in that performance, it sounded like a record was skipping at times.
Yeah, just a little inside baseball is that that performance was originally early in the evening where Jamie Foxx was, and Jamie was back there. And at a certain point, we realized it might be a better performance when the kids were asleep.
It was the Adam Lambert rule kicked in. I wish they'd used the mute. I wish they'd used the mute on Quentin Tarantino's introduction. Now, did you guys write that for him, or did he come up with that himself?
No, don't blame Quentin. You could blame me directly.
No, I'm not blaming you, but it's the way he delivers it, which I love. It's that manic over the top delivery.
Again, I wouldn't throw any blame at him. We go to him for that. We need at 11 o'clock or whenever it is, you want a surge of energy, and we want him to go out there like the boxing announcer he can be and introduce a heavyweight bout.
Mm-hmm. You must have fun when you get to write something where you have like Mos Def and Placido Domingo on stage together. That has to just that's a kick to try and come up with something for them to banter about.
Well, that was interesting. Let's move on.
Oh,
I guess it wasn't. It was an awkward moment during the telecast. And
listen. For the most part, they're like these would seem like impossible dreams. Like, okay, how do we put together the wonderfully cute girl from The Big Bang Theory with, you know, the sort of political Latin singer songwriter of his times to give out an award for something else entirely? And it becomes like a mathematical equation, and usually you get the right answer. Sometimes you don't.
Well, now, Jeff, you said that one of your favorite parts of the show was Pink's performance, in which she kind of was wearing, well, I guess, little to nothing, and then wound up doing this Cirque du Soleil routine where she was completely drenched and turned into, like, I don't know, a lawn sprinkler and started spraying water at everybody as she twirled around in the air. It looked absolutely amazing on television, I can tell you that. What was the reaction of the journalists? I don't know where you were, either backstage or in the audience, but what was the reaction?
I was actually in the water, oddly enough. No, I think, you know, I saw, I was sitting with David watching it during rehearsals on Thursday, two or three times, and I was just so struck by it. And then seeing it on the show, I was very nervous about it just because of all the moving parts involved. Just as a spectator, it's that wonderful anxiety of watching something that's sort of a high wire act. I thought it was really impressive, and it's something that she's done during her tour, of course. I mean, that's part of her stage show, so it's something that she's comfortable doing. I think Ken Ehrlich and his team were smart enough to say, okay, you know what, just do what you do during your tour, during our show. It's good enough that it presents and that it fits in, and they didn't feel the need to kind of come up with a contrived new thing for her. So I think that's one of the reasons it went so smoothly. But it's interesting. And I at the part where she says, you know, about, call me sugar, and then they dunk her. I didn't know if it was supposed to be coffee or I think there's a metaphor there. I don't know if she's a tea bag. I'm not really sure. And the costume was, you know, basically bandages. It was good on many levels.
I have to say Jeff is right, and the amazing thing is just technically, I don't think people have any sense of what goes into the production of putting that much on a stage in one night. So the challenge there was, you know, when she does it on her tour, she's the only person on that tour. You know, you actually do get into battles of divas over who can fly, because, you know, it's like, it's kind of like wearing the same dress. You know, you later have someone else who goes, no, I want to fly. And it literally, it's not the space. There's not the real estate above the stage to do everything you want to do. So Pink decided she wanted to fly early and often, which was a good decision ultimately.
Well, now, was anybody upset sitting underneath her? Because she was spraying water all over the place, and all of these people are in, well, at least most of them were in tuxedos.
Formal wear.
I actually was, we had the same thought. I know that Ken has expressed the same sort of thought, but in truth, at least from where I'm like 20 feet behind the stage, so I have a skewed perspective, and I, in fact, miss a lot of the show, because I'm dealing with, if Stephen Colbert, one of the people, was talking to me, I'm not watching, so I didn't see a lot of the show yet. But I remember afterwards, that was maybe the most intense reaction, just in terms of reverberations you're hearing from backstage. Right? I think people just loved it.
Yeah, I loved it. One of my other favorite moments was Justin Bieber's apparent ad lib, where he messed up the names Bon Jovi and Beyonce, and then said, "Oh, sorry, I just always have Beyonce on the mind." What was one of your other favorite moments, David?
My favorite moment was when they gave me my paycheck. That tends to be a recurring theme in my life. My favorite moments in the show. I actually thought the moment when Elton John and Gaga actually were going back and forth. I guess there was a certain theatricality to The Rock, and I agree very much with Jeff that this was, in terms of my favorite bands, because there weren't a lot of bands on this show. I thought that, like, for instance, Green Day was doing a Broadway version of Green Day, which I thought was great and epic and good for TV. But I thought that moment with all the theater of Gaga was great and interesting and arty and cool. But when it just came down to her and Elton going back and forth and actually singing and playing, you know, and actually musically connecting, that was phenomenal to me. I love that.
Well, Green Day won Best Rock Album yesterday for 21st Century Breakdown. And Lady Gaga, I think, didn't win anything, at least during the telecast.
She won two earlier.
Oh, okay. She won Best Dance Album, but that wasn't during the telecast, was it?
No, they had very few awards handed out during the telecast. What was your favorite award, Jeff?
My favorite moments were the ones that we were talking about as far as performances. And among the winners, I was happy to see Kings of Leon win an award just because, you know, I am kind of a guitar guy, and it's kind of fun to see a band pick up a major award in a year where I don't think anybody was really expecting that. And then my favorite moment that was sort of off the air was backstage. I got to watch one of the stranger moments when Alice Cooper, in his sort of goth Sgt. Pepper's outfit, crossed paths with Smokey Robinson, who is remarkably preserved and like almost eerily. But it was interesting watching them watch each other. And here's guys that, you know, when I was a kid would have nothing in common. But of course, what you really realize is that they, you know, they've lived their life in show business. They know the same people and the same physics of the industry and stuff. And you realize that these artists that seem so different to us as fans, that if you put them in the same room, they all actually have much, much, much more in common than most people would anticipate.
Well, Kings of Leon won Record of the Year for You, Somebody. And
yay.
Right.
Well, I would have to say that for me, that Green Day Broadway version of 21st Century Breakdown, it was amazing.
Yeah, I quite liked. I thought it was quite strong. You know, I think we learned a little bit about. I mean, the weird things that factor into why a TV show does well, why an event does well. I was realizing because when I heard that the ratings were great, I assumed, wow, so the Pro Bowl must have done badly. It turns out the Pro Bowl was a massive hit as well, up like 40%. I think what happened is we did a show that was very female-friendly between the Michael Jackson and all the women, the Taylor Swift. I think everyone in America stayed home, and a lot of the men watched the Pro Bowl, a lot of the women watched the Grammys. I think it really was not just the year of the women in terms of what happened on stage and in the awards. I think a lot of these music shows skew very male in my limited experience, and I think we managed to, by having a narrative of these women and the sort of the competition of these young women in different genres. I mean, I often put jokes in for myself because no one else will laugh, but there was even a little line I tried to put in. I think it got through in one of the bumpers, which was, can Taylor Swift beat her elders? And her elders being like Lady Gaga and Beyonce, who are, you know, not exactly ancient, certainly by my standards. And see, I think part of what was going on is like, there's actually a sort of inter-genre, intergenerational, actually people engaged in the awards, you know, and who would actually have the big night. Because I think it's hard to make people care individually about, you know, awards, but there is this sort of phenomena. The biggest nights, I've done the show for 10 years, and the biggest nights have been when there's been this sort of narrative.
Well, and Beyonce won an award for Song of the Year for her song Single Ladies, Put a Ring on
It.
And now her performance, she brought the Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation dancers back to life.
Yes.
And she grabbed her crotch at one point in time, something that Michael Jackson used to do a lot of. There was a huge tribute last night to Michael Jackson, which is, it seemed to go over rather well. It was done in 3D for the television audiences.
That was entirely, I got to say, Ken Ehrlich and Jeff, I think you probably were aware of this too. Like the 3D aspect, I think there were a lot of things, reasons why that couldn't be done and wouldn't work, and he just wouldn't let it go. And as Jeff can tell you, he can be dogged when he wants to do something, and he fought that fight. And I think that's another huge reason the show did so well, is that you had, because I tweet and I got people telling me, I'm at Target and there's like a run on the glasses. I think in the last few days people were shopping for the weekend at Target, where the glasses were exclusively being distributed. And I think that's another weird part of the story. But can I just say something about Jeff while we're all talking?
Absolutely. Okay?
Oh, no.
Okay. Now, Jeff, I heard something that you describe yourself, you used the word geek. I just want to say a horrible moment for me during this Grammys was I had to listen to a group of industry women say something like, God, he's kind of hunky for a journalist. Now, admittedly, that's marking on a very low curve, but I feel calling yourself a geek, it's like if I could call myself a geek, I think Jeff is, frankly, as a journalist, I question your integrity if you're calling yourself a geek.
I am Gaga at this point. I have no idea how to respond to that.
But not Lady Gaga, just Plain Gaga.
It's just Gaga. Just plain Gaga. Well, that's very nice of you, David. I think you better.
I'm happy about it. I'm just telling the truth. Because they're still part
of the I think I got their nickname because I write about comic books. I think that's more
exactly.
Okay. I think all right.
Yeah. Not for your stashing good looks. Well, David, congratulations on the success of the show, and also for Hope for Haiti, the George Clooney special to raise money, which also went very well.
Yeah, you know, I don't have points on either one, which is probably only right, but I'm glad they both did really, really well. And yeah, thank you.
Well, now, Jeff, when Taylor Swift and Stevie Nicks were on stage singing, I don't know where you were, either in the audience or backstage in the press room, what was the reaction around you, whether it be the audience's reaction or the press room's reaction? Because at home, it definitely looked like there was a huge difference in singing ability between Stevie Nicks, who's a fantastic singer, and
Taylor Swift, who was like somebody singing on her bed.
Right.
Well, I think, you know, what you have to remember, and I was in the audience at that point, is that, you know, unlike the Golden Globes or unlike the Oscars, this is a very large building. This is, you know, where the Lakers play, and it's not like the Kodak Theater or the Beverly Hilton Ballroom. So you got 15,000-16,000 people, and the higher you went in that building seating wise, the more people liked Taylor Swift, because the seats at the top were the fans and the seats at the bottom were people that were smiling thinly. And if they were artists, like, holy cow, that girl cannot sing, or a record executive saying, I don't care, she just sells records. So, and then also there's this thing too, is you have to remember too, is that these people are, you know, they respect Taylor because she writes her own songs and she works really hard and she goes on tour and she handles herself well in person. She does things for the label. She does things for the Academy. I mean, she's a good citizen as far as the commercial responsibilities and sort of showing up with style and class and stuff. So she's not a despised figure or anything like that.
No.
But you did see some people kind of look at each other and their eyebrows would go up in a different shape. And then someone sitting next to me, who I quoted in my story, said, well, as a singer, she's a great actress, which I thought was a really telling thing, because it sort of, she knows what singers look like.
Yes. I just have a slightly different point of view, and I've been around her a great deal because I write at the CMAs, the Country Music Awards as well. So I've had a full dose of, you know, her impact. You know, she is a phenomenon beyond the other two shows. Wednesday, I help with a benefit that Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks and their wives host, a breast cancer event Wednesday. So that's where I was late Wednesday night. And I'm sitting backstage watching Taylor Swift literally hang like with total grace with Tom Hanks and Spielberg, who are fairly heavyweight, you know, as good as it gets in this business. And I just thought, I've never seen anybody who can sort of rise to the occasion in this way. And I think her vocal, whatever you want to call it, limitations. I think it helps her as an artist, because she's basically become the stand-in for every young, starts with women and it seems to, you know, blend to, like, I have a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old of two boys. They love her. But I think she is expressing, you know, the coming of age, and I think it's better she's not Mariah Carey. I think it's better, you know, she's basically dealing with the awkward, you know, realities of coming to life, and I think that's more meaningful and real and relatable if it's coming from a girl who sings like a girl at the campfire than it does necessarily coming from, you know,
Hilary Duff.
Christina Aguilera, who is a magnificent singer, but I just think there's something powerful. I think it's not like it's holding her back. I think it's helping.
That's well said.
That's very nice.
I mean, there weren't really too many surprises in the awards of the 12 that were handed out. I mean, maybe Best New Artist, which went to the Zac Brown Band. I guess that was kind of a toss-up. Nobody knew who was going to win that one.
I thought that's the one I was sure of.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. The only one I was sure of.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I just kind of had a little hope for MGMT, but I guess nobody really knows who they are. David, you've had a very busy week and a very successful week, and I have to say, Jeff, you have too. You interviewed Mel Gibson, one of the first interviews in, I think, 7 or 8 years that he gave. You also had a wonderful story on basically, I don't know how to say that, whether it's marketing or promoting yourself as a rock band.
Yeah, it's we did a piece on Sunday, and I would love for your listeners to check it out. They can find it on the LATimes.com. It was about a band called The Afternoons and their search for what exactly is the rock and roll dream now here in the 21st century, here in Los Angeles, a town where people have been coming to become rock stars for many, many years now. And really, it wasn't a story so much about them as it was the experience of what it's like to be a band on the edge and as the rules are getting changed. So, but I'm glad you enjoyed it. We were very happy with the piece. We got a really strong response to that piece. And
I'm sorry, can I add that as a recovering journalist myself, I beyond my, of course, previously expressed crush on Jeff, I will say that, like, I have this weird job where I work writing speeches and TV events for stars. I am a journalist, was a journalist, all the different parts of the food chain. And generally, I hate journalists, even though I am one. And most of the people, you know, hate dealing with journalists. And even though he's always, you know, tough and honest, Jeff is one of the only journalists I've ever seen, and I think I was this when I was doing more journalism. But people are actually like happy to talk to him because he knows what he's talking about, and he's fair, and he's very good, and he's never actually, you know, mentioned me, but I still respect him.
Well, there's you can imagine how awkward this is because we have an expose on David tomorrow in the paper.
That's going to be embarrassing.
It's all going to be very terribly awkward. So. But thank you for the kind words. And, you know, I mean, we are very proud. I do believe the LA Times has some of the best coverage in the country in this sector. And so if you guys, if your listeners can check it out, that would be something that would make us all happy.
I would like to plug that for the first time ever, I live tweeted from backstage at the Grammys, and some of the worst photos ever taken of major stars, if you go to at Wild About Music. That's WILD, Wild About Music. I think I have the first shot of Neil Portnoy kissing or being kissed by Taylor as she walked off stage. I have my wife and Stephen Colbert, and I haven't seen her since that photo. There's a really horrifically structured shot of Ringo, Norah Jones, and her boyfriend. So I would suggest people go there for the kind of uninsightful, poorly spelled journalism, if that's what they're looking for.
Well, I know you're both very, very busy and probably very tired after last night, so I'm speaking for all of us here. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Just pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye. Take care.
Bye. Well, that was very nice of Jeff Boucher from the Los Angeles Times and David Wild, who was one of the writers on the Grammy Awards, to join us to discuss the award show, which aired last night. But we now have to move from music to film, and wrapping up the Sundance Film Festival, joining us now is Allison Wilmore, a senior editor at IFC.com. Welcome, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you make of this year's festival?
I thought that it was overall a pretty strong festival. I thought, as often is the case, the docs were a little stronger overall than the narrative films, but I feel like I saw some great narrative films as well, and certainly ones that I had some heated debates over, which is always kind of the best sign.
What was the heated debate over? What film?
I would say The Killer Inside Me, absolutely. That
loved it, or you know, hated it?
I liked it a lot. Most people
actually
seem to
can
have
you say real
it.
Quick what it's about, because I don't know.
Sure,
my
it's a Jim Thompson adaptation. It's actually been made into a film once before, but you know, it's the kind of darkest and pulpiest of the pulp kind of settings, and it's set in a small town in West Texas. It's a noir in which Casey Affleck plays this deputy sheriff who's got more than a dark side. He, you know, starts off with beating women and kind of goes downhill from there.
So he's a bad guy.
He's a bad guy, but he's also the main character, and he, you know, there's something kind of innately sympathetic about Casey Affleck, even when he's being incredibly disturbing. So it was a really interesting film. it's definitely one of the most violent films I've ever seen. That's not necessarily part of my recommendation, but it's it kind of, you have to be braced for it.
Well, are you a part of IndieWire's critic list?
You know, I'm very behind on sending in my updates, but yes, technically I am.
Well, they had a list of the top 10 competition films and 10 best non-competition films, and the 5 worst films based on the critics who were reviewing them up at Sundance, and The Killer Inside Me came in at number 5 as 5 worst films. Now, as you said, it somewhat divided audiences. Also on that list were Shock Doctrine, a film I really liked, which was the documentary also by Michael Winterbottom, Obsoletia, which I can't even pronounce that name, Bass Ackwards, and 12, Joel Schumacher's most recent film, rounded out the list there. But the 10 best competition films, I was kind of, as you said, intrigued by this, because the top 4 films are all documentaries, and it used to be that I would go to Sundance and only watch documentaries. They were some of the best films up there, and certainly some of the best documentaries made that year. Gasland topped the list, a documentary by Josh Fox, which won the Special Jury Prize for Documentary, 12th in Delaware, which was a film about abortion rights, and Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. It was kind of a documentary about her life and where she is today. It won the Documentary Editing Award. Did you see that, Allison?
I did not, but everyone I talked to seemed surprised, really, by how well-made it was, in addition to being entertaining.
Yeah, I found it entertaining, and it was one of the better films I saw up there. Of course, Restrepo, which is Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington's film, that received a lot of buzz up there. It's the film that follows an army platoon in Afghanistan for 15 months. It won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary, so it won the documentary's top prize. And it's not until the 5th film, Winner's Bone, that you actually have a dramatic entry in IndieWire's list here. Deborah Granik's film won the Grand Jury Prize for the dramatic competition and also won the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award. Did you see Winter's Bone?
I actually sent one of my other writers, James Rocky, to review it, and he loved it. I was sorry I didn't get a chance to see it, but it did get picked up, so it's one I'm very much looking forward to.
Well, what were your favorite films of the festival?
My favorite personally would be Blue Valentine, which is one that I had been hoping would win the prize for, you know, in the U.S. narrative competition. It didn't, but I think it's probably, you know, it stands head and shoulders above all the rest of the films for me right now.
I really enjoyed that film as well. I thought that's a film that just stays with you. It's a film by, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Derek Cianfrance.
That sounds pretty close. Yeah.
It stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams as a married couple, and it cross-cuts the last 24 hours of their marriage as it's effectively falling apart with the story of how they fell in love, and it's emotionally devastating. I really enjoyed it, and I was a little shocked that it didn't win anything at the awards ceremony.
I was too. That was absolutely the film that I heard people calling out as, you know, the find. Every year you have one or two of those films that really you see, like, make you excited again about American indie film. And for me, that Blue Valentine was that film. And, you know, Ryan Gosling, Michelle Williams as the couple, they're both, I think, really maybe the two best young actors working today. And they were just phenomenal. And as you said, heartbreaking. It's very difficult to watch a realistic portrayal of both people falling in love and falling out of love.
At the same time.
It sounds like a bittersweet spin on 500 Days of Summer, and also maybe an updating of the Harold Pinter play Betrayal, where you see them at the end where they've broken apart and then you go backwards to where they sort of first fall in love.
Yeah, you know, there's certainly a kind of subgenre of the maybe out of sequence anti-romance, as you said, the Harold Pinter. And there's also 500 Days of Summer. And last year there was Peter and Vandy that was also at Sundance. Didn't go very far, but had the same kind of story. This one I'd say is probably the most heartbreaking of all of them, just because it's also very grounded in small details. I know that the director went out of his way to kind of make sure that you knew how much, like, what kind of income level they were living at, you know, these small details about how they met, what their relationships were before this point, where they're living. And it makes it all the more, it makes you all the more invested in their story. You know, it's very, very realistic in that sense, and kind of, and that's what it aims for.
Now, did you see The Animal Kingdom? This was the Australian film that was kind of a genre piece. It won the World Cinema Jury Prize.
I did not. You're picking all of the ones I didn't get to see.
Well, what about Exit at the Gift Shop? This was kind of the surprise unannounced film at the festival by a graffiti artist named Banksy, and it tops IndieWire's 10 best non-competition films.
I did see that, and that I enjoyed that film very much. You know, Banksy is such an oddly compelling figure, given that he does not, you don't see his face in the film. He's, you know, anonymous, prefers to keep his identity a secret. So he appears with his voice disguised and kind of in the shadow. And yet he's very funny. Like he offers this kind of commentary throughout about the subject of the film, who is kind of a friend of his who becomes an artist. And he seems like a very kind of charming character, very dryly funny.
Well, there was another film by Tamara Davis about an artist, Jean-Michel Basquiat, but there were two films about paparazzi, Smash's Camera by Leon Gass, which won the directing award, and Teenage Paparazzo by Adrien Grenier, who, of course, is from Entourage. Did you see either of those films?
I did not. But interestingly, over the course of the festival, I heard maybe like a 50-50 split between people who liked one or the other.
Well, there was a 3D documentary, Cane Toads, which I saw. Kind of interesting. Did you see that?
I didn't. What did you think of that?
Allison Wilmore.
I can run you through the list of
Thanks
the 26
for joining us.
I saw.
But well, apparently as we all know, having gone to film festivals, you can go to Cannes and see like 45 movies and none of them get awards, or they're the opposite from the 45 films that the person next to you saw. That's always the case. What was it like overall for the festival with the recession and the economy? It was less crowded than previous years. It sounds like it was a good market with 10 films being sold. So it sounds like It was a positive one as far as the industry is concerned.
I mean, I know I was certainly surprised that the first few films to get picked up were, you know, 12, which was not very well received, the Joel Schumacher movie, and then Buried, you know, to kind of maybe they're safer picks to have a genre films or films that are filled with kind of more marketable teen stars. But, you know, it seems like now people are coming around and picking up the more traditionally Sundance films like Blue Valentine, which the Weinstein Company picked up, like Hesher, and like Winter's Bone, which also got a pickup, which is nice to see, given that it doesn't have a lot of big stars. It does seem like people were more cautious this year in terms of acquisitions, but it still remains, you know, the major American indie film marketplace.
And what movie do you hope nobody picks up?
What movie do I was not a fan of Obsoletia. You know, it just seemed to me to be a throwback to a lot of the things I didn't like about kind of indie quirk that I was hoping, I always hope that American films can get away from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, otherwise, though, there was nothing that made me enraged. I'm still also waiting to see someone pick up Catfish, which is probably one of the most talked about films at the festival, a documentary about
a Facebook
relationship.
Oh, you're supposed to not know anything going into it.
Not know anything?
Yes. Everybody says, don't find out anything about the film before you go into it.
I don't think that knowing it's about a Facebook relationship will spoil it in any way.
Okay. Well, I was surprised Happy Thank You More Please was not picked up, Josh Radnor's film. It won the Dramatic Audience Award. And as far as Catfish goes, apparently Paramount may be circling, or there are rumors about Paramount because there's a screening of it tomorrow on the Paramount lot.
Interesting. I know that the filmmakers have said that they want this to be the kind of documentary version of Paranormal Activities. For what that's worth.
Well, Paramount Vantage picked up Waiting for Superman, which was the Davis Guggenheim documentary about education, before the festival even began. But there were a couple of pretty big acquisitions at this festival. Focus Features picked up The Kids Are All Right for $5 million. I think that's a little rich for that film. It's a movie that stars Annette Bening and Julianne Moore as lesbian lovers, and their world is turned upside down when their children seek out their sperm-donating biological father, who's played by Mark Ruffalo.
I think we saw the same screening of this movie. It is hard to imagine it'll be the kind of, you know, I thought it was fine, but that it'll make back $5 million plus marketing costs. It's not really, it doesn't seem like a big movie, a big indie film in that way.
Well, you mentioned Buried was picked up, which stars Ryan Reynolds and is shot entirely inside a coffin. That's he's buried alive in Iraq. Lionsgate picked that up for $3.2 million. And Hesher, which received very mixed reviews, was picked up by New Market for $1 million. Winter's Bone, you mentioned, was picked up. But here's where things started to get more realistic. Low to mid six figures is what Roadside Attractions paid for it. And for Blue Valentine, The Weinstein Company picked it up for $1 million, and IFC Films, The Killer Inside Me, your one of your favorite films, $1.5 million.
I mean, you can certainly see the landscape changing in that way. Films like Bass Ackwards, you know, did their own release, kind of, I believe they did YouTube and then maybe DVD as well, immediately after the festival premiere. Then you had IFC Films had a selection of films that they put on Sundance Selects on VOD at the same time to kind of try and get the interest of, in the festival to lead to people buying the films on VOD as well.
Well, you sent me to a film that was also on YouTube, Homewrecker, directed by the Barnes brothers, Todd and Brad, and it was fantastic. Now, this is a film that appeared in the Next section. It won the Best of Next Award on Saturday evening, and the Next section is filled with films that cost under $200,000. And thank goodness for digital video, because there's no way shooting film you could do that. It was a fun film. It was really good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Homewrecker. It, you know, had such a kind of modest setup, and it really, I think, is a testament to acting and also just being generous with your characters and letting them seem like fully fleshed out, you know, living, breathing human beings.
Yeah, it's a film about a guy who is on work release from jail, who is pining after his ex-girlfriend who, well, I won't give away a secret there, but and then runs into some crazy woman who believes her boyfriend is cheating on him. Okay, I can't say. I'm gender challenged today. She believes her boyfriend is cheating on her and gets this man out on work release who is a locksmith to break into his apartment and go and talk to him. I mean, it just kind of spirals out of control, and it's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, a great use of also when you know you're working with limited resources, what you can do, keeping that in mind. It was, I thought it was really, really charming. It definitely deserved that prize.
Now, a prize that I think a lot of people were raising their eyebrows at was the special jury prize in the dramatic category, Sympathy for Delicious, which was directed by Mark Ruffalo and starred Christopher Thornton, and who also wrote the film, who is in a wheelchair and played a DJ who has recently become a paraplegic. By the way, little side note, both are my former housemates, Christopher Thornton and Mark Ruffalo.
I'm suddenly jealous of you.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that they've been working on this film for 10 years. And, you know, I saw it, and it wasn't a horrible film. It wasn't atrocious the way some Sundance entries can be, but I know it wasn't one of the best films up there, and it didn't have you running out of the theater screaming, you know, you have to see this movie. But a lot of people reacted quite negatively towards this film, so I was a little surprised that it won an award.
It's definitely one that I heard a lot of people raking over the coals, but at the same time, I think a lot of people mentioned it as a film that is very interesting in what it attempts to do. You know, and I think that there's a certain amount of points for ambition that, and again, with the prizes, it's always so difficult to tell. They often don't reflect, you know, what happens after the festival in terms of box office success or in terms of acclaim. It seems very much to be specific to that moment at Sundance.
That's very much like Cannes. Overall, at the end of the day, this Sundance is going to be remembered for John Cooper's inauguration. I think it went quite well.
I agree. I think that, you know, the Next program, the Spotlight program, the embrace of films that are not necessarily world premieres was lovely. And I think that getting back to having some low budget films and really spotlighting them was great to see. The idea of it being Renewed Rebellion, I know a lot of people were skeptical of in the beginning, that being the new slogan. But I think that it really, there was a lot of effort put into getting back to that very low budget, you know, very indie film.
And just one final question. Who are some of the new talent to be looking for? Who's the next big filmmaker? Who's the next big actor to have come out of Sundance?
Well, I mean, I mentioned Blue Valentine, and I think that's absolutely the director of that. Absolutely. It's not his first film either. He had one earlier that kind of was a very small film, but I think he's going to go far, especially if that film gets the kind of release it deserves. I could see it being a real awards magnet. I think that Chris Morris, who directed Four Lions, who's a British comedian who's well established in the UK already, is, you know, just an incredible talent. I have mixed feelings about the film, but he's definitely, you know, not afraid to go to difficult places. and Nowhere Boy, and Aaron Johnson, the lead, is, you know, already poised on the cusp of stardom. He's got Kick-Ass coming out in a few months, but he's, you know, he's really got this kind of star quality, and he's one I would definitely look out for.
And every year I pick either a director or an actor or a writer who will go on to next year be one of the awards contenders. And this year, I would have to say, if it's seen, Jennifer Lawrence, who is the lead in Winter's Bone, will be the big breakout star. Much like I said last year, Monique would be, if Precious was seen, which at the time was called Push, that she would be competing for Best Supporting Actress. And when I told her that, it was like the nominations hadn't even been announced yet for the 2009 Oscars. And she said, oh, you go on. But sure enough, look at it. I mean, I think, I know you didn't see it, Allison, but that performance is really, really good.
I will look out for it.
Now, Allison, we're going to put some links to your work in our show notes, but you're also on Twitter.
I am on Twitter.
It's at Allison Wilmore, or?
Yep, Allison with one L, Wilmore with two.
Ah, ooh, you've practiced that, I think.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Talk to you
Thanks
soon.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was great of Allison. She was really interesting interview. I've never heard her talk before, but she was great.
Unlike myself today, who can't keep their gender straight, she is one of the most knowledgeable critics and film journalists I know, and she's a fantastic writer. You should really go to ifc.com and read her. Another wonderful writer is Karina Longworth, who is now the chief film critic, I guess, or film editor over at the LA Weekly, and some of her reviews from Sundance were just fantastic, especially the one of Blue Valentine.
Well, you should include a link on the show notes.
I absolutely will. I was very happy that Allison was able to join us today, as well as Jeff Boucher from the LA Times and David Wilde from, well, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and one of the writers on the Grammys.
Yeah, they're always fun.
And it was certainly a big deal that the Grammys exploded in the ratings this week.
Segway alert.
Are you trying to bring us to Big Deal or Big Whoop, or should we actually talk about Jay Leno, dare I ask?
Absolutely. I watched the Oprah special. Jay Leno was on Oprah. Did anybody else watch it, or just the highlights?
I watched the whole thing.
Oprah sat down with him on his set for an hour. She offered Conan the same thing, but he didn't feel it was the right time. So what did you think, Karen? Did it change your mind at all, or give you any empathy or insight into him, or make him like him less or more, no different?
I believe that he believes that he is a good guy. It doesn't change my thoughts on him, no.
What about Oprah thinking that, you know, where she says, look, it's not your show. You don't get to decide who gets the show. She's like, that's not how it works. She's like, people say, oh, you stole the show from him. It's not yours. It's NBC's. You have no power to make them give you the show back.
But she also brought up the point that he did have the ability to say no and to walk away.
Sure. So did Conan. When they said, Conan, Jay Leno's the number one show at late night. We'd like you to walk away and not take the show, even though we're offering it to you. But he said, no, I want it. So it's the same
thing. But it was in his contract to get it.
Oh, we're not going to get into this again.
Please spare me. The one thing I thought Oprah failed on, she was very good on emotions and feeling. But the one thing she failed on was that Jay repeatedly said that, hey, he was canceled in prime time because his show didn't work. And he said, and Conan was canceled for the same reason. His show had terrible ratings. And we're like, yeah, because your show had historic lows leading into the local news, which hurt the ratings for the Tonight Show. So
yeah,
I wish
see,
she'd
so
asked him that
one. I'm so glad to have heard you say that. Yeah, no, I noticed that you didn't say that too.
Yeah, absolutely. So sorry. But I thought it was interesting that he would go on Oprah. It shows how much damage control he needs to do. There's no reason for Conan to go on. I thought it was interesting how empathetic she was to him. I thought it was an interesting interview. I felt he wasn't too defensive, and I didn't really get too much new insight, but I thought it was interesting.
Was it a big deal?
It was a big deal.
Yeah,
it was a big deal.
As was the
fact that NBC announced they picked up two shows from Conan O'Brien's development company. They fired him, and they picked up an hour-long drama called Justice, which is about a person on the Supreme Court who retires and then opens a law firm. And they also picked up a sitcom called Pink House about two straight guy pals who move in together in L.A. after college, modeled perhaps after Sperling and Mark Ruffalo.
Pink House is not Conan O'Brien's production company. Just Justice is.
Oh, I thought Pink House was as well. I misread the press release. Well, I think it's interesting. They pick up his show. To me, it proves it's all business.
Well, I know exactly where they could put Justice. in the 10 o'clock hour on Mondays. I hear there's a huge hole right there.
I think there was a show called Justice. It was on at the 10 o'clock hour on Sunday.
That's hilarious.
Well, let's get into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we determine whether the top entertainment news stories of the week are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story today is about Lost, the television show, which begins its final season this week, I believe, on Wednesday or Thursday. Is this a big
Tuesday?
Tuesday, sorry. Good grief. is this a big deal, Karen?
Yes.
Okay, enough said. Michael.
No, I stopped watching in the middle of the second season. I don't care. I'll watch the finale. That's it.
Well, then you must be watching Jersey Shore, which will return for a second season. Now, this is the reality show that follows around a whole bunch of Guidos, as they call themselves, on the Jersey Shore during the summer. It aired on MTV. It's going to go into a second season. Michael, is this a big deal?
Forget about it. Of course it's a big deal. It's their biggest hit in years.
Karen?
Huge deal, especially since Snooki, who is the breakout star, is probably going to have her own show.
Yeah. Heaven help us. Meanwhile, Michael Bay has announced Transformers 3 and its release date of July 1st, 2011. He is going to be working on the script with Aaron Kruger, who is actually an NYU classmate of mine. Is this a big deal or not? Karen?
Big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal for the studio. It's a billion-dollar franchise practically worldwide. So it's a big deal, I guess. God help us all.
Our next story is about Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, who are together again, sort of. At least they have the same publicist. Cruise has moved from Rogers & Cowan to the PR firm 42 West, where Katie Holmes, his present wife, is represented. Now, Nicole Kidman is represented by Leslie Dart. Cruise will be handled by Amanda Lundberg, two different publicists at the same firm. Is this a big deal, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's all business.
Yeah, I agree. For the same reason. No, and, it's been 10 years. No one cares.
Our next story is about Apple. Last week, Steve Jobs finally announced the highly anticipated tablet, which, Michael, kudos to you. You actually called it an iPad at the beginning of episode 39 last week. So I don't know how you knew that or whether you have to have a bodyguard now to prevent Steve Jobs from hunting you down or what. But is this the announcement of this product, which was supposed to be kind of the second coming for ingesting or digesting media, is this a big deal or not? Karen?
The iPad is a huge deal. Despite the fact that it, I wouldn't say dead on arrival, but it doesn't seem like they completely thought it through as to what niche it was supposed to belong to, it's nevertheless a big deal.
Michael?
It's somewhere between a big deal and a big whoop. It's a big deal because they're launching it. It's a big whoop without Hulu. If they're saying they want you to browse on your iPad and you can't watch TV shows on
That's
Hulu.
Not Flash.
Which is half, yeah, they don't have Flash still. They've got to fix that at 2.0 or I don't think it's going to work. I think it'll be like Apple TV. It's just something that's not ready for prime time yet. I want it, and yet I wouldn't pay for it.
Well, I'm with you. I thought it was a huge disappointment, and I think the reason it doesn't have Flash is because Apple is one of the backers of HTML5, which
but
is...
they can't do it. They can't, you can't say, oh, look at this $800 toy to surf the web. Oh, you can't watch that website. Oh, I get annoyed when that happens on my iPhone. On a thing designed for that, it would be infuriating.
Our next story is about Scarlett Johansson, who is finding a new role, this time on Broadway. The screen actress is taking to the stage for the very first time. She's playing Catherine, the center of a tragic, sexualized battle in the Broadway revival of Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge. Oh, that must be a hard role for her, playing a sexualized character in anything. Michael, who, this is right up your alley. Is this a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal. It opened. It got great reviews. She got great reviews as a stage actress, not just as a movie star slumming it. So and she's a real talent. And it's a great role and a great play. So it is a big deal.
I agree for the same reason.
Speaking of actresses, Sandra Bullock, the biggest female star in the world right now, is up for a Razzie for All About Steve and frontrunner for the Oscar for The Blind Side. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. Nobody cares. Just the fact that she did so well on The Blind Side, it's going to take over anything bad about All About Steve, I think.
Michael?
It's a big deal. It's funny. It's historic. And I bet she shows up and accepts the award in person because she's a fun gal.
That concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. We should move right along into our next segment, Inside Baseball, in which we are talking about Miramax once again, and possibly for the last time. It is shutting down. Disney has finally pulled the plug. It will live on as a shell of its former self, as a distribution arm within Disney's film division, with six releases still to go in its pipeline.
It's almost hard to believe, because Miramax is, I mean, I remember when Orion collapsed, and that seemed shocking because they had a run of Oscar winners and you thought they would never go away. And now Miramax has been part of the landscape for decades. I mean, when did they form? In the 80s, was it? It's just,
I think they've been around for 20 years. I would say early 90s.
Well, they had a 25th anniversary or 20th anniversary. So,
yeah, so every company, you know, except for, I guess, four or five major studios, everybody comes and goes. United Artists is no more. You know, it's just everything can fade away.
MGM is on the block. They just got an extension on their loan. Yeah. Well, you know, this is a company that between 1992 and 2002, 11 years, they had 13 Best Film Oscar nominations. That can't possibly be right because there's only 11 years. I don't know how that's possible. They missed out in 2003 and then had double nominations in 2004. That's how they did it. Two nominations in 1 year. Okay.
And their library is worth, they're trying to sell the name in the 500 title library for $1.5 billion. How much is that per title, I wonder? What is 500 into 1? It's like $300,000 a title?
I don't know, but I do know that the Weinstein Company, or at least the Weinstein brothers, Harvey and Bob, did make overtures to try and purchase the name back.
Yeah.
Well,
they should. It's named after their parents. It feels like an end of an era, though, doesn't it? Makes me feel old.
Well, for Miramax, it's the end of an era. For us, it's the end of this podcast. You can find links to all of the stories we discussed on today's podcast at showbizsandbox.com. You can look them up in episode 40. Our website is where you will also find links to all of our social networking accounts, such as Facebook and Twitter. It is also where you will find links and information on how to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Send us your comments, your thoughts, your well, actually.
Love letters.
Yeah.
Anything. Love letters.
Yes, love letters, please.
Address those to Karen.
And my goal.
Karen@showbizsandbox.com.
Wow. Times must be tough. Or you can give Karen a call, or Michael or I a call. You can do that. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll free, 888-567-7263. Feel free to leave us a voicemail. Now, the music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, who did not win a Grammy Award last night for Best New Artist. They can be found on myspace.com/MGMT or on their website, whoismgmt.com. I'd like to thank Jeff Boucher from the Los Angeles Times and David Wilde, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and one of the writers on the Grammys, for joining us, as well as Allison Wilmore, a senior editor at ifc.com. We'll place links to all of their work in the show notes. Michael Giltz can be found at michaelgiltz.com, as well as on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. Karen Woodward can be found on karenwoodwardonline.com. That's a long...
Hey, Karen Woodward was taken by some actress.
Oh, okay. Well, you can also be found on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. I can be found on Celluloid Junkie, as well as on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.